Oh, Rosie. Look, the sun's going down. I forgot it gets dark so much earlier these days. You up for a walk before we lose the light completely? Yeah? All right, come on, let's do it.
I added one more podcast to the giant podcast bin. Now you have plucked that podcast out and started listening.
I took my microphone and found some human folk. Then I recorded all the noises while we spoke.
My name is Adam Buxton, I'm a man.
I want you to enjoy this, that's the plan.
Hey, how you doing, podcasts? Adam Buxton here, reporting to you from the evening time. I thought it was late afternoon of a beautiful day towards the end of September, yes, 2021. Then I looked up and it was evening, bang. Not even gloaming. Actually, maybe this is gloaming. And with my not amazing eyesight, everything is getting all fuzzy and blurry. Rosie, who has decided to join me for this walk, she likes an evening walk. She's up ahead, but she's just a sort of black blur at the moment. Before I tell you about my guest for this episode, I did just want to give you a bit of book tour info. Wow! Just turned the corner on the track. Now looking over to the west. It's the last bits of light after the sun has set. Still a bit of orange over there. Shut up, Buckles. Get your boring book tour info done, will you? All right, calm down. Blimey. Yeah, quick reminder about these book tour shows. Most of these shows, I'm glad to say, Richmond, Brighton, Edinburgh, York, Cardiff, Birmingham, Norwich, Manchester, they're sold out. I mean, it's always worth turning up if you're able to do that, because there are always returns. There's always a few people who weren't able to make the rescheduled dates. So, you know, if you were desperate to come along to a show that was supposedly sold out, it's worth taking a punt, but obviously couldn't guarantee. However, there are still tickets available for the following as I speak. The Aldridge Theatre, Farnham in Surrey on Sunday the 3rd of October. Delawarr Pavilion, Bexhill-on-Sea, Monday the 4th of October, few tickets left. Further back in the stalls. Tynan Theatre, Opera House, Newcastle, Wednesday 13th of October. Few tickets there, not many. One or two left for the Marlowe Theatre, Canterbury, on the 23rd of October. Empire Theatre, Inverness, on the 4th of November. Regular podcasts may recall me saying it didn't look as if anyone in Inverness was at all interested in coming to see Adam Buxton rambling. I think half the tickets have now been sold, but there's still quite a lot of room there, so do come along. Then there's Ireland dates in late November for Belfast. Nearly sold out, that one. Cork. That one recently went on sale. Not nearly sold out. And Dublin doesn't appear to be on sale yet. There's a link in the description to all the book tour dates. Apologies once again to people who bought tickets last year and cannot now make the rescheduled dates. Thanks to those who can, and I will do my best to provide an evening of electrifying reading, music, question answering, possibly book signing, depending on your local COVID regs. I hope to see you. All right, now let me tell you a little bit about podcast number 162, which features a rambling conversation with British comedian, actor, and artist James Roderick Moir, also known as Vic Reeves. Jim Facts. Jim, currently aged 62, was born in Leeds, then moved to County Durham with his family at the age of five. After an apprenticeship in mechanical engineering at a County Durham factory, Jim moved to London, where his studies included a stint at art college towards the beginning of the 80s, where his passion for painting first flourished. Meanwhile, Jim started performing at so-called alternative comedy shows in London around that time. One of the people that attended One of those, a performance by Jim's showbiz alter ego, Vic Reeves, was Bob Mortimer, who volunteered to join Jim on the stage. And, as they say, the rest, as they say, is history, as they say. Vic Reeves, big night out, the smell of Reeves and Mortimer, bang, bang, it's Reeves and Mortimer, and shooting stars all helped make Vic and Bob two of the biggest, and for my money, the funniest names in UK comedy throughout the 90s. As well as continuing to collaborate with Bob Mortimer and taking on the odd acting and presenting roles on TV, Jim now spends much of his time making art, with works ranging from figurative paintings of birds to pictures that are kind of fine art versions of Jim's TV comedy work. By turns cartoonish, grotesque, surreal, and sometimes very funny. My conversation with Jim was recorded face to face, hey, back in the room, on a rainy morning earlier this month, September 2021, in the house that Jim shares with his wife Nancy and their teenage daughters. Jim also has a son, Louis, currently in his mid-20s and working on a documentary film called A Brush with Comedy about the intersection between humour and fine art. I talked with Jim about breakfast, the value in being sparing with bad language, although, ironically, there's quite a bit of bad language in that bit, just so you're aware. We talked about art and the art life. I got to wheel out my nearly meeting David Bowie story again, and Jim told me about his close encounters with a couple of other British music legends. Back at the end, but right now, with Jim Wire, a.k.a. Vic Reeves, here we go. Just for levels, tell me what you had for breakfast.
I had one of John West's tuna infusions.
What's a tuna infusion?
It's a small tin of tuna, but John West had the brilliant idea of infusing it with lemon and thyme, amongst other things. But then you mix that with a bit of mayonnaise, put it on toast.
That sounds good.
You've got
good.
A winner.
Yeah. But I'm curious to know about your morning routine anyway.
Yeah.
So what time are you what time are you having the tuna infusion?
Tuna infusion. This is the first time I've tried the tuna infusion, but I'm a big admirer of John West and all his products.
Yeah.
I do like fish for breakfast. In fact, thinking about it, I am a big fishophile.
Yeah.
For breakfast. But anyway, so this morning it was tuna infused with lemon and thyme, which I mixed with mayonnaise and put it on toast at 7 o'clock this morning, 7 a.m. Other mornings I might have pickled herrings. Other mornings, if it's a special occasion, I get some sardines with a little bit of Tabasco on, salt and vinegar, on toast.
Nice.
Fishy breakfast.
Brown toast?
Oh, yeah. When I was a kid, people used to have Mother's Pride, and that was luxury. But I don't know, is it still luxury? Because I come from a brown bread family, you know, it was a bit bohemian, it was health food. My mum claims she was the first person in Britain to import muesli.
That's very progressive.
Well, it was a progressive household. This is in the late 60s.
Yeah.
When muesli, well, it's probably used as a base to mop up budgie shit in a cage, but we decided to eat it.
Good eating habits early on.
Yeah.
So they weren't coming back and feeding you non-stop burgers and mash and...
No, it was all, as far as I remember, it was a very, quite a foodie house. We were vegetarians for years as well.
Really?
When it wasn't you know, there was the only other vegetarian in the world was John Lennon, I think.
Yeah.
Or maybe Paul McCartney. But so we were vegetarians, really uncool.
Did people at school know that you were vegetarian and tease you about it?
Yeah, it's like, it was a very namby-pamby thing to do.
Yeah, definitely. I remember even, you know, growing up in the 80s, I didn't know any vegetarians. And it just seemed like the strangest thing. And then when I heard about vegans,
yeah,
it's like, you're joking, aren't you? What, you don't even eat eggs? What's wrong with eggs?
Yeah, well, they say I do love eggs.
Yeah.
And fish. I couldn't involve myself with the world of veganism.
That's too much.
Far too far for
me. I mean, I've tried, like, if tomorrow suddenly the edict came down, okay, it's all vegan now. I want to be able to cope.
Yeah.
And I want to know that it's going to be enjoyable. There's still fun things to be eaten. Obviously, there are.
Not cheese, though.
No, but I don't like cheese anyway.
Really?
Yeah.
No, you're the first person I've ever met.
I've had this exact conversation a few times, but I was staying with a friend yesterday and had the same thing. He was like, I've never met anyone who doesn't like cheese. Is it really that unusual?
I think it probably is, unless you're Japanese.
Oh, yeah, okay. That's maybe why I like Japan so much.
Oh, I love Japan, but I can really see their point. You know, if you think, right, let's get this cow and squeeze some juice out of it, then let it go off. And that sounds delicious. You know, they've got a point when it comes to cheese, but, you know, sometimes you don't have to, you shouldn't think about those things. Just enjoy the cheese. Oh, and then the other thing is a Stilton cup, which the Georgians used to enjoy, which is you put maggots in, and then when the maggots eat the cheese, you drink the maggots and the cheese in a kind of soup.
Oh.
I've not gone that far.
No.
Mind you, yogurt's pretty bad. You know, when you think about it, let's get some of that juice that we've squeezed out of that beast and then introduce a bacteria.
It's monstrous.
That's the other thing we used to do when we were kids. My mum, we used to make our own yogurt. We used to have a big, like, you get the yogurt mother thing, seed, whatever it is, you know, and then we'd
make... Spore culture.
The culture, yeah. And we'd make our own yogurt in a bucket.
Were your parents actual hippies then?
Well, it was not hippies, no, but it was quite a crafty area. My dad would make like plates and cups and things out of wood.
Okay.
And my mum would paint them with floral designs and little devices on them. I mean, they weren't hippies or beatniks, but they were kind of maybe Victorian crafty people, that sort of thing, you know, like arts and crafts movement.
But were they considered a little bit fringe and a bit odd by the local community?
Compared to my other friends, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And what about things like TV then? Were they suspicious of that?
Oh, yeah, that was... you had to give reasons why you wanted to watch Land of the Giants or The Man from U.N.C.L.E. because it was like you get like almost written permission. And my dad, when the TV was on, he used to make me laugh every time. He says, look, I know what you're laughing at because the TV would be on. And he said to me, Mum, he said, right, can we have it off now? I'd laugh my head off and he was going, look... It's not that fun. Every time I say that, you know what I mean.
That phrase used to make me laugh a lot as well.
Yeah, did you get it as well?
People don't say having it off anymore, do they?
No, or having it away.
Have it off.
You're having it off as well. That's another one you can do.
Were they funny, your parents?
Yeah, yeah. My dad was, especially, he's dead now, but he was very funny. There was a lot of face pulling.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And funny voices?
Yeah. You know, he's from the Goons generation, so there was a lot of that, you know.
A lot of
Goons style voices.
Hey, boy, kind of talking like that. Yeah, yeah. Which is good. And so you got into that.
I never really got the Goons too much anyway.
Uh-huh, I know what you mean.
I didn't really listen to much comedy. I'll watch it, really. So I don't know where it was. Things like my mum and dad talking at close quarters. It was real life.
What did your parents do for a living, to go back to them?
My dad worked at the... Well, I was born in Leeds, and he worked at the Yorkshire Post.
Okay.
And then we moved to Darlington, because he moved to the Northern Echo, so he worked at the newspaper.
What was he doing there? Was he a journalist?
He was a printer.
Oh, a printer.
Yeah. Come from a long line of printers. I did... Who Do You Think You Are? They did the pilot on me.
Yeah.
because I've got quite a ridiculous story. But on my dad's side, it just goes back centuries and centuries into Scotland of printers who have nothing of any unusuality at all, really boring. Yeah. On my mum's side, it's a lot more exciting. Do you want a brief outline?
Yeah, man.
Right, on my mum's side, my grandma came from America. My mum's father was the son of head butler and head maid at very big houses around Britain. And this lord and lady knocked him over in their carriage and said, "Oh, we're so sorry, we'll pay for his hospitalisation, and we haven't got any kids, so can we bring him up?" So he's brought up aristocratically. Went and got married later on, after he'd been brought up in his big house. He went and got married, went to the First World War, left his wife and three children, and just never went back to him. Went off to Leeds, met my grandmother, who'd just come from America, who was, I think, about 19, and my granddad was in his 50s. So they got married and had my mum and my uncle, but she said they just sort of like drifted around and he didn't work. He was always on the dole.
Your granddad?
Yeah, but he was like this aristocrat on the dole.
Yeah.
A fake aristocrat.
That's like a movie.
It could be, couldn't it? Yeah.
And the...
And I'll get to play him. No, I'm too old for him now. I'll play the old fella who adopted him.
Yes, you could be Lord,
I think somewhere in Essex, Rickmansworth, I think it was.
Well, what an interesting family they must have been as well. I would imagine that not everybody in their position would have made that decision.
Well, I think they were quite nice people.
Yeah.
There's pictures of them with Edward VII. Apparently he used to sing for Edward VII and also keep guard for Edward VII.
While Edward VII was doing what?
Whatever it was he was doing. For half a crown, apparently.
His little private guardsman.
Yeah.
So what did your parents inherit from him then? What did your mum... Like, did she have a lot of memories of him that she told
she
you about?
She didn't really like him. But there was a lot of table manners that had to be impeccable.
Okay, yeah.
Did you ever have that?
Yes, my dad, his parents worked in a stately home or a posh house. They were servants. And so...
Well, so the same as mine, but mine, the head butler and head maid.
Yes, my grandfather was also sort of head butler, chauffeur, and then kind of
knew each other.
Groundskeeper, yeah.
Yeah, so same sort of thing. So so you were brought up with the impeccable table manners, and it all has to be like... almost measured, like the knives and forks have to be in the right spot, and the soup spoons and everything, in the right place.
So you had all that?
Yeah.
And so you were brought up a polite young man?
Yeah.
Okay.
And because I was talking to my kids yesterday, and I said, I was hearing on the radio that your generation is the sweariest generation ever in history. And I said, my granddad always used to say to me, this is my other granddad, he said, swearing's all right if you just pick your moment. He said, it can be like a bomb. If you swear all the time, it's going to have no effect. But, and also, that he says, a person who swears all the time is incapable of understanding the English language and can't find the word to put in its place.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of like almost shaming him into not swearing.
I think I've made the exact same speech to my children because recently, now that the boys are a little older, 17, 19, the other day my 17-year-old unleashed the F-bomb at the dinner table.
I thought it was at the postman.
No, we have a nice postman. And it was in the context that it was reported speech, right?
So he was... Oh, right. So he was... Yeah, okay.
He wasn't saying, give me the fucking ketchup.
Where did you get these fucking sausages?
Not fucking fish again. No, he was reporting someone else. He was sort of saying, yeah, this guy was like, fuck you, you know. And I kind of, in the moment, I was thinking that I should say, like, can we not swear at the dinner table? I mean, you guys know I'm fine with swearing. I love to swear. But exactly as your grandfather would have done, I've had the conversation before. I've said, like, swearing is fun. Like, a good swear is great. And I love to hear a good swear. But yeah, if it's all the time, you debase the currency.
Yeah.
And all the fun goes out of it.
So what did you do? Just ignore it?
I let it slide because I thought, fair enough. It's not like he's effing and jeffing right the way through every meal.
What you could have done is slam your knife and fork down and then said nothing.
Walked out. And he would have had to come and find me in my study.
No, you slam your knife and fork down and then stare at your dinner for a bit and then carry on. That would say so much more.
Or I could have just looked at him, like held eye contact with him,
yeah,
and then looked away.
Maybe he was doing it to see, you know, because he would have thought, I'm going to see what response I'm going to get here.
Yeah, I don't think he keeps a diary, but if he does, that would have been a diary entry, surely. But then a couple of weeks after that, now here's a story about, you know, you let one F-bomb through. A couple of weeks after that, C-bomb.
What, not at dinner?
Yeah.
No.
And at that point...
He's working you up, isn't he? And but he can't go much further than that.
No. Where do you go after that?
I suppose, built it up a bit more.
But again, it was reported.
Yeah.
So where you go after that is direct usage, like calling me that word, I suppose. We haven't got there yet. But at that point, I did say, actually, can we not have the actual word at supper? Yeah.
You might remember this because we both started about the same time on telly, didn't we, in the early 90s?
We were a little bit after you, but yeah.
But I mean, it was still there. In, you know, you used to go into the, if you're in the BBC, into an executive's office, on the wall would be the swear list.
Oh, yeah.
And it'd be like right at the top was, I think, God, Jesus, anything religious. And that was the top, that was the worst one you could get. Anything religious was the worst. And then it would go down with all the Anglo-Saxons, all those words. I would imagine it's a lot more race-based now.
Yeah, yeah.
It'll look right at the top. And the God stuff. And this wasn't that long ago. That'll be down the bottom because I think you can get away with any kind of religious.
Pretty much. America is a lot more religious still, I think, than the UK. I don't know exactly what I'm talking about, but... Yeah, it feels like, I mean, you forget though, because the media is so secular, I think, but you forget that overall, you know, at least 90% of people in the world are still religious, you know.
Yeah.
They're the majority. So.
Because I always look at, I don't know if you do, but I look on IMDb.
IMDb.
I can never get this right. and I look at the parents' guide.
Mm.
For my own use, because I don't like to see people's heads getting blown off.
Yeah.
So I look at the violence and gore section. And then if you look at the swear profanity section,
mm-hmm,
on the parents' guide, it'll say, use of Jesus 3 minutes in. So you get a lot of that in there. Because people are thinking, I can't watch that because they're using the Lord's name in vain.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. My dad was certainly, he didn't like that.
No, I used to get at school. I used to get in big trouble.
Yeah,
for that was the worst thing you could do. And then after that, you get in trouble saying crap.
When yeah,
I was at school.
I say crap too often now. I must say, every now and again, you're kind of reminded. Oh, I'm sort of saying shit. Really, is what I'm saying. But crap just seems so innocuous. Me and Joe used to, every other word was crap when we were on TV.
Oh, yeah.
We all used to say twat as well. But yeah, being Southerners, we didn't realise how offensive it was the further north you go.
Is it?
Yeah, I think it's like the C word.
Really? I knew it was sweary. No one really knows what it is, do they? Is it a lady's part? Or yeah, is it a pregnant goldfish? I just presumed it was a pregnant goldfish because that's what I was told.
A pregnant goldfish.
In the 70s.
Well, there's prat, isn't there? A prat is something as well.
That's an arse, isn't it? A pratfall. You fall over, you know.
All right, I'm going to have to Google this.
Prat?
Yeah.
Prat and twat. I can't let this one slide.
I think it's a very grey area.
Prat, British, incompetent or stupid person. Yes, yeah. Okay. A person's buttocks. There you go. That's exactly what you said. Okay, so yes, person's bottom. How about...
Twat.
Twat.
I didn't think it was more offensive in the north than the south.
That's what I understand. When we were on XFM, me and Joe, we used the word a fair bit until the station boss came in and said, don't say that anymore, please. It's really offensive for people like in the north.
For twats.
For twats.
they keep referring to me. And it's really getting upsetting.
The twats are really unhappy about it. Stupid or obnoxious person, a woman's genitals.
Right.
Or to hit or punch someone. If my best mate said that, I'd twat him. So it doesn't.
Yeah, I got twatted.
Yeah.
I've never forget, that is true, isn't it? Yeah. But nothing about pregnant goldfish. I think that was just a rumour that was going around town by Robert Wyatt.
that's what that song was actually about.
Hello. 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 Hello.
So in the mornings when you're here, you paint, right?
Yeah, I get up about 6:30 and I paint every day virtually until lunchtime. And then I have lunch and go for a walk.
Is it always oils that you paint in, or do you just go...
No, I've done a lot of... these are all watercolours here.
Oh, wow.
And people really like birds. I mean, because it's my main job now, and I really like it, because, I don't know, I'm not retired and I never will retire, but I've kind of retired myself away from television.
Yeah.
Because I really like staying at home and painting pictures, and I make... probably more money, so it just makes sense. This morning I've been down the printers. I take stuff down there. It's a cottage industry.
Yeah. Well, my Christmas present last year from my wife was a print of yours.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, and it was various Bowie heads.
Oh, right.
And it was very funny. And it was the watercolours that I'm looking at over on the table behind you now are beautiful, fairly straightforward pictures of birds. Like, yeah, they're not mad.
No, you know, I know what I sell.
Yeah.
And there's like, there's things I really want to do. And I really like doing the birds.
Yeah.
And but then again, I might want to veer off into a fantasy land.
I think your stuff is great. And I envy your lifestyle. That's something I really would love to do. I went to art school. I don't think I'm as good a painter as you, but I would love to be able just to incorporate that into my daily routine, just drawing or making stuff, whatever. But the...
You could.
I could, yeah. I mean, I'm waiting. Did you make a decision at some point? Did you...
Well, that's what I was doing before I was on TV.
Yeah.
I had art shows and I worked in a gallery. I went to art school and I sold paintings, and then I ended up kind of doing it on stage and then on TV, doing an art performance. And then that kind of took over. But I've never stopped. When I did, you know, even when we used to do the big night out and the smell of reeds and whatnot, it was always full of my artwork.
Yeah.
On the, you know, it was kind of incorporated. So it's all one and the same thing to me.
And the stuff you were doing at art college then and the paintings you were selling then, were they sort of nutty or were they fairly straightforward representational?
Actually, I'll show you.
Oh, cool.
I found this the other day. It's a little leaflet. Look, this is in 96. Look.
Oh, wow.
And I wrote that.
The Garden Gallery. Exhibitions January 86 to June 86. Monson Road, New Cross Gate. Admission free. James R. Moyer. James paints to the sound of a flourish of trumpets. His paintings are classic, romantic, and bombastic. They are beautiful works of art with just a hint of blatant plagiarism. Moyer paints Aphrodite and Adonis alongside the proud and mighty hog. His paintings have been shown all over Europe and are in numerous collections around the world.
Yeah.
This unbridled passion for painting and paintings has produced some extraordinarily brilliant and soulful masterpieces. And then, is that actually one of your paintings?
That is. That's a painting, a copy of a painting by David, which I was doing at the time. I was copying... masters.
Yeah, which is a sort of legitimate thing to do for artists, and isn't it?
But I was working at this gallery.
Yeah.
Because I put my own, you know, there was the bloke who ran the gallery, and he said, well, why don't you do a show in here and you can write your own bit of blurb. So that's why it is so fantastic. So that was what I was doing in 1986. Yeah. And then after that, I ended up doing it on the stage, you know, stuff on the stage, which all, you know, and then after that, we're on TV. But there's the birds, and then there's the, all the rest of it has got comedy involved, which my son's doing, Louis is doing a film called A Brush With Comedy, which is about people who do comedy and art.
Yeah, of whom there are many.
There are, and it's a lot. There is a big comedy. It's like when you look at all the pop stars who've been to art school.
Yeah.
Like virtually, you know, there's the Beatles, the Stones, the Who, and
Roxy Music. Blur
and Roxy Music, yes. And there is a big link. So there's art, music, and comedy, and it's all.
Yeah, they all cross over.
Yeah.
Because you're all trying to find unusual ways of expressing what it's like to be alive and what the world looks like.
Well, it's ways of looking, isn't it?
Yes.
Trying John to... Burgess said. And but you're the same. You went to art school and then you ended up doing comedy, and you just it's ways of seeing things.
Uh-huh.
And then you've got the chicken in the basket style comedians who just...
report what's already there.
There's that. And then you've got the... Because I think you probably fit into the same category as me, as the art school comics. You know, the people who do comedy that have been to art school and see things in an art school way, which would be Noel Fielding and Harry Hill. You can see, you know, those people. I mean, I say it's chicken in a basket. I presume that's still what you get at a working man's club Saturday night.
You get tofu sausages.
Is it chicken in a basket still, or is that in the past?
I've never had chicken in a basket.
If you work in class, the poshest thing you can get is chicken in a basket.
Yeah. Like, I always wondered, like, is it breaded chicken? Anyway, this is not...
It's just a chicken dinner, but it's presented in a basket.
They just dumped it in a basket.
You know, it's like now you go to places and they'll put your dinner on a slate.
Oh, yes.
It's the same sort of thing. Yeah. But, I mean, if I had a restaurant, I'd serve it on a clock face or something like that.
Well, I do feel like I love... that world of comedians and musicians, the art school scene. But I always felt slightly outside it, because I think that there is within that world a division between people who have a genuinely unusual perspective on the world. And I would put you in that category. And then people who are a fan of that way of looking at the world and aspire to emulate it somehow. And I think I'm probably in that category. So I'm more kind of pulling things apart and analyzing how they work and things like that. But I think you don't feel the need to do that, right? You're not someone who is going out and watching loads of comedy and saying, how does this work? And
no, I never watch comedy.
Yeah.
Really. I try and give things a bit of, you know, I give about 5 minutes. It seems nowadays I usually abandon it quite early.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's funny in America, because I think some American comedy is the best. The best that ever, better than British, and then most of it is worse than anything. But Britain are the innovators, if you like, I think.
Who were the people that you liked then? Who did make you laugh when you came across them?
I always liked, the stuff that made me really like was Laurel and Hardy and the Three Stooges and stuff like that. But I didn't really watch a lot of TV, a great deal, certainly not any comedy, because it just wasn't on the radar in our house.
Biscuits, I am in love with you. I'll dip you in my tea, but pull you out before you fall apart. I won't abandon you. Biscuits, nice.
You've got on with David Bowie on your laptop.
Yes, that's a sticker that came with a book about him.
You weren't with him then?
No, it looks authentic, but it's just because it's...
Have you ever met him?
I met Bowie very briefly backstage at Maida Vale.
What were you doing there?
Jonathan Ross had invited me and Joe to go and see Bowie play. It would have been around 2003.
Oh, it was a concert?
Yeah. It was a small concert he did for the BBC for Radio 2. At that point, I was a little bit jaded about him. I sort of thought, well, his best years are behind him. He's not really doing anything interesting anymore. But still, he's Bowie, and I want to go and see him. And it was quite exciting. And he was very good, actually. And he asked Jonathan if he had any requests. Like, he said, is there anything you want me to play? And Jonathan
That was
said,
good.
That's one of my only impressions.
Can you do it again, or is that?
Yes, certainly, yes.
Oh, that is good, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm looking through my binoculars.
You see, that's... That's the kind of... No, that's... What's he called? The guy who did Stella Street. That's the Phil Cornwell Bowie.
Is it?
Yeah, that's a bit more kind of wobbly.
Or is it like Anthony Newley? I love Anthony Newley.
So did Bowie, of course. Wanted to be like that. And so I think that's part of the reason that Bowie had this... He had this slightly...
It's a bit nasal.
Cockney thing, and also quite sibilant with the S's.
He's a bit nasal, then, isn't he?
Yes.
You've got that. That's good, that. Anyway, yes, so...
Anyway, so there was David, and he asked Jonathan if he had any requests. And Jonathan said, oh, let me check, because he knew that me and Joe were big fans. I wasn't around, apparently, so he called Joe. Joe said, ask him to play Bewley Brothers. Do you know that song?
Yeah.
Off Hunky Dory. Bowie hadn't played it ever live. I think I'm right in saying that. Maybe a Bowie nut will tell me, maybe he performed it before. But it was certainly one of the first times he'd ever performed it live.
So he knew he was going to do it?
No, they worked it up for the show because Joe had requested it via Jonathan.
So he requested it early, so it wasn't just a surprise.
No, no. It was good. And then we saw him in the corridor afterwards. He came towards us. Jonathan said, do you want to meet him? And we were like, yeah. But then, and I've told this story before, but then Ricky Gervais sideswiped us. He kind of appeared, and the Office was just becoming a thing at that point. And Bowie said, oh, hello, I love your show. I love The Office. It's hilarious. And that was the end of that. We never got a look in. So we sort of, we exchanged glances, but before we'd been properly introduced,
oh, no.
Him and Ricky went off and held hands and became lovers.
That's terrible, isn't it?
Oh, I was gutted.
He could have waited his turn. I did see him once when I was on Top of the Pops, and he was in his band Tin Machine.
Oh, yes.
And I think he had this idea that he was like a heavy metalist, and he kind of ponced about a bit like that and was playing the part. So I don't think I saw Bowie, but not the real Bowie. It was him playing the part of a heavy metal presenter.
Did you talk to him at all?
No, he kind of sort of like thrust his way through people looking a bit hard.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, that's not you. You're just putting that on, aren't you? Anyway, how about this? Just thinking that I was at Jeff Beck's wedding, and there was a rockabilly band on stage, and it was like people were getting up and singing a song. So I think Jeff said, go up and do something. So I would go up and... So I was on stage with Paul McCartney and Jimmy Page, and they said, what are we going to do? And I said, can we do I've Got a Lovely Bunch of Coconuts? So I did, and there's no evidence of me doing this, but it did happen. So I'm stood with Paul McCartney on one side and Jimmy Page on the other, and I'm in the middle like the lead singer doing I've Got a Lovely Bunch of Coconuts, of which I only knew the first verse, and then Paul took over and knew everything.
Oh, really?
But Paul McCartney is one of those people who will know the words and play anything. So that was, no
So evidence. Were they both playing guitar then?
Yeah, with me in the middle.
Wow. Okay, here are the lyrics to I've Got a Lovely Bunch of Coconuts. God, there's loads.
I know.
How does it begin then?
I've got a lovely bunch of coconuts. See them all standing in a row. Big ones, small ones, some as big as your head. Give it a twist, a flick, a wrist. That's what the showman said. And then that's me done. But this, you know, always when you go on stage, especially with legends, make sure you know all the lyrics. Oh, I was like, over to you, Paul.
I mean, you must have had a few crazy encounters at the height of your pop fame.
Yeah, do you know what it's like when you think something and you can't say it? Because Bob and me did a song with Tom Jones once. It was before he'd let his hair go white, and he obviously cared quite a lot about his perm.
Mm-hmm.
And it had been pulled this way and that, and the perm was very tight, and we were really close together. And I smelt the pomade in his hair, and it kind of put me off the... Because I was really concentrating on his hair, thinking about it too much that I forgot the lyrics. I forgot completely what I was doing, where I was or anything. Intoxicated by Jones's hair.
What was the song you were doing?
I can't remember. I really don't. It was one of those things that you do for like comic relief or something. Okay. It was 25 years ago maybe. But
are you a Googler? Do you Google stuff when you don't know them?
Yeah, I Google really rubbish things. Yeah. You know, I don't. Yeah, I do.
On the night of 1,000 shows, 2000.
Don't know what that means. In 2000?
Yeah. Is that the one? Vic Reeves and Bob Mortimer recreating old Morecambe and Wise routine with Tom Jones.
I expect that's what it would be then, yeah. Yeah, you can. Can you see his really tight perm?
Yeah,
that's before he let it go. Yeah, I remember just being mesmerised by his hair and the scent of it. Then we went off to the bar, and he's a really nice bloke. Yeah. Tom. He's like, we went off to the BBC bar, and he just started telling us stories like about. He was going, oh, yeah, when I started off, he was just working in his clubs, you know, in the valleys. And he says, he's living on a Saturday night, a nice punch up at the end of it. But he was just telling stories about, not his showbiz, it was just like what he used to get up to in the valleys.
Yeah.
And then you went to Vegas. He was going, oh, yeah. He said, I had an airplane, dresses, people like that. He says, well, best thing for me, I had a fucking lake. Like, that is the best thing. What makes you think a lake is better than a private jet? Oh, he's a really nice bloke, Tom.
He seems like it.
Yeah.
And then you were touring around, like, Dizzy was, I mean, that's one of the very few number ones that a comedian has had, a British comedian.
Well, it's probably the first one, because when we started off, we were, like, courted by the NME.
Oh, yeah.
It was like we were comedy rock and roll.
Yeah. Because
we came from a kind of arty rock and, you know.
It was sort of indie comedy.
We used to knock about with indie bands.
Yeah.
And people like, so it wasn't too much of a leap. But the first thing I did was Born Free.
Born free as the wind blows.
That was number 3 in the charts. And then Dizzy was number 1. And then after that, I had another number 3 with I'm a Believer.
Then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer.
Oh, yeah.
And curiously, I'm going out on tour with Jules Holland doing those 3 songs.
Are you?
Yeah, I'm doing 5 nights.
Because
Jules said, do you want to come? And I just liked it. And I thought, I like doing those things where it's. I think with someone else, I wouldn't do it, but I like the idea of just because he's my mate. That sounds like good fun, you know, getting about somewhere, going to Plymouth and doing that.
You were in bands, though, right, when you were a young man?
Yeah.
What kind of bands?
Sort of indie, punky, sort of, you know. You know what I mean. I don't know how to describe it. One of them's called Hot Murder. It was the one band that I was in. Because in the 70s, we used to change the name of the band. It was the same band, but we used to change the name all the time. So it might be, they called it Rum, or Bobby and Jackie Charlton's Eerie Mansion, or the Dig Me, I'm Django. We changed the name every gig so no one would know who we were, so that we couldn't get any fans. Because we thought that was the kind of punk rock attitude to things is like, you know, you don't want people to like you. What are you talking about? So, and then we took it to an extreme because, so we're in this band and I said, why don't we just not have a name at all, but we have some flasks of curry? And people go, it's that band that smell like curry. But then we thought, if we do another gig, you haven't got a name, so you can't do a poster. And then if it is, it's the band that smell like curry. It just looks like a comedy group. So
exactly. It always
comes down.
You can't
have anything on the poster. So it's completely negated. So the next best thing is just not have a band.
But when you were doing all your band stuff and things like that, were you already into the art scene? Were you already thinking about Dada and Hugo Ball and nonsense poetry.
I've never stopped thinking about that sort of area.
Yeah. Where did you get exposed to that then?
I think it's a very showy off thing. You know, if you look at things like Dadaism and Surrealism and things like that, it was like Yves Tanguy would eat spiders, for instance, at parties. And, you know, there's nothing particularly arty, but it's just showing off, isn't it?
It's quite good, though. I mean, it's not nice to the spiders. But you liked the idea of being someone who was knowledgeable about these things and associated with them. And would you behave in a self-consciously odd way then to freak people out?
I suppose so, because we had a gang in our late teens and we used to go and see arty films and go on marauding trips to art galleries to go and check things out. And we all used to wear the same, we had yellow jumpers and black trousers and be a kind of aloof and separate gang to everyone else. In fact, we did, we forced a deja vu on Generation X once. We went to see him, I think it was at Newcastle University, and we were sat on a long bench table, all five of us in our yellow jumpers and black trousers, and Billy Idol came past and looked at us. We went, "Hello, Billy," and he walked past on his way to the stage, and then he went, "Hey," and then I think they were on about 5 weeks later as well, and we went and did exactly the same thing. And said, "Oh, hi, Billy." And then he walked past and then turned around and looked back again, like full deja vu. Did this just happen? Or did it happen 5 weeks ago? And I think that's a great thing, to force deja vus onto people. You can go out of your way to force a deja vu.
To make someone feel crazy.
I think it's probably pretty easy to do.
Yeah. Looking at Hugo Ball's nonsense poem, Gaji Berry Bimba.
Yeah.
I was reading an article about it in The Guardian that was written in 2009 by Carol Rumens. And, you know, the whole Dada thing is so interesting, isn't it? Because it was such a reaction against politics at the time, I suppose.
Well, that's what people say. I mean, you know, I'm not an expert on Dadaism at all, but people are always looking, still looking now, even probably even more now, looking for reason. And I think Dada is the actual opposite of reason, so, but people are still trying to find some reason. Why did he do that? And they said it was in opposition to First World War fighting. But I don't think it was. I think it was, like most people from art school, just doing something daft. Which trivialises it fantastically, but that's the truth.
I suppose you can say, though, that you're operating within a structure and some of, whether you know it or not, whether it's conscious or not, these are responses to your environment. So Hugo Ball and the Dadaists, whether it was intentional or conscious, there must have been something about witnessing the horrors of the First World War that made them more receptive to the idea of just being silly and...
Well, there might have been something like that. That's why they went off to Switzerland and set up shop there, which was away from the war. So there were conscientious objectors, white featherites and all sorts of, you know, so they probably wouldn't have been going, blowing trumpets saying this is how bad war is, because everyone was going to war and they would have been in probably in a lot of trouble if they'd have started blowing trumpets about being anti-war.
Yeah, exactly. It's like politics is sort of inescapable in that way. You can't really opt out. Opting out is in itself a political statement. You feel that a lot now, don't you think?
Like, yeah.
Politics has become so exhausting and so divisive in so many ways, but it's like it's not really good enough. I say this as someone who doesn't feel qualified to sound off about politics on the whole, but it's like I sometimes feel like people think, well, that's not good enough. You know, you can't just opt out.
I keep away from politics as much as I possibly can.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm qualified to say anything about it, but it seems like it's, from my outsider's point of view, picture, it seems like it's, I've never known it as much of a competition.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, oh, if you say that, I'm going to say the opposite. And let's see who wins. Not about what's right and wrong. It's like, let's see who can win this. You know, if I say this, I'm going to say the opposite and then we'll fight it out. You know, I mean, I don't have any video games, but it seems like life is quite a video game. Do you do video games?
A little bit. I always feel guilty when I play them. I feel like, no disrespect to the gamers and the people who create them, because I really do think there's an incredible amount of amazing creativity in that industry. But I do feel, for whatever reason, that it's a total waste of time. Like, I feel as if I read a book or even watched a film, then I would be, it would be a more meaningful engagement.
I'm with you, but I think we come from that generation.
Yeah.
And it's the competition from the generation that you and I grew up in is to have knowledge and not to have got to level 5 on a jumping game.
But, even though, I mean, I really love them. I think I'm afraid of them because...
They're too addictive. Don't get me wrong, I have played them, but I just wouldn't have now because I know I'd probably get addicted and I know I would be not very good. It'd just get me wound up.
Hmm.
And do you feel guilty about things?
Yeah, much? I really do.
Do you feel guilty about maybe watching a movie on an afternoon?
It depends what movie, but yes, a little bit.
Yeah. Now this is the, if it was a shitty movie, I'd feel guilty, but I would be maybe feel all right if it was a 1962 British kitchen sink movie.
Exactly right. Yeah. I mean, it's silly, isn't it? Because there's nothing inherently valuable about something that's a bit older, but it feels that way. It feels like, oh, this is legit. And I'm, in a way, not only am I watching a movie, but this is kind of like learning about history or something, or I'm doing something.
And then you feel guilty if you do something. But it's the same thing. If, you know, playing a video game, I'd probably feel guilty at any time of day, but in an afternoon, it's almost like a sickness.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I was in a lineup once for some award thing or something or other, and I was stood next to Alec Guinness. And I was talking to him because it was like being in a queue to get into I didn't even know what it was. So I was stood in this queue with Alec Guinness and talking to him. And he said, I spent all my life, I've never smoked, nor drank, nor taken drugs. But next week, I'm 80 and I'm going to start on the heroin.
Did he really say that?
Yeah. I don't know if he ever did, but that's what he said to me. But that's the thing, yeah. You can sometimes be too goody-goody, can't you? And you might have missed out. Like.
Yeah, I suppose so. Heroin, though. It's very Moorish. The film that I watched the other day in the afternoon and felt okay about was Rafifi.
Yeah.
Have you seen that one?
I'm not sure if I have. I probably have. It was...
supposedly one of the greatest heist movies ever made.
Is it Italian?
French. Jules Dessine,
yeah.
I think, is the director.
But I used to go and see films like this at the cinema in London in the late 70s, early 80s. Mm. All the time, we'd go and see films like that, you know. And then it got to the point where I'd seen a double bill at some little cinema in Rupert Street, and it was Le Petitmain, which was good, the farting Frenchman.
Oh, yeah.
And this was an Italian version of it, and that was good. So, but it was on a screen which was probably smaller than a current TV screen. And then after that, there was a documentary about T. Dan Smith, the corrupt councillor from Newcastle in the 60s and 70s. I thought, these art films, I'm going to start going to see, you know, Close Encounters and Harrison Ford films.
The blockbusters.
Yeah.
But that double bill sounds like a template for a lot of Vic and Bob stuff.
Well, it was. And then also, Bob and me went to Los Angeles in 1992, and it started raining. It was the floods of 92. We were stuck there for 3 weeks in this house in Laurel Canyon,
whoa,
watching the Three Stooges and taking notes, and came back and did The Smell of Rose and Mortimer.
Did you literally take notes?
Yeah, absolutely.
What kind of things were you noting down? Do you remember?
Well, you know, like, must use this, you know, kick Bob in the face and then turn the foot around and grind it well in. After saying earlier on that I wasn't fond of
violence,
there is room for it.
Yeah, when it's a giant frying pan.
There's a great Three Stooges film where they're trying to fix a telegraph pole and they have boots on it with spikes on them and they keep standing on each other's heads with these spikes that get stuck into the tops of their heads. It is the most violent thing ever, but it's hilarious. And like, but when, you know, kind of reduced to the fact that someone's just got a 4-inch spike stuck in the top of their head and goes, whoa, 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 whoa.
They used to really hurt themselves doing some of that stuff.
Oh, they would do. I mean, we did. Bob and me did.
Did you?
Yeah.
What kind of things?
Well, the earliest one I remember is there was it was the largest diamond in the world, which contained a puppy, and it swung down across the stage and smacked Bob straight in the face, and I think knocked him out.
I think that's still in the show, though, right? That shot.
It's all in there, yeah. But we used to really hit each other with pans and things. You know, you can't not. I think health and safety might have something to say about these things now.
Yeah.
But you have to do it.
Bob gets terrible rheumatism, doesn't he?
Yeah, he had bad arthritis, rheumatism.
Arthritis,
stuff.
Yeah.
And, but he kind of got over it, I think, with his various other ill healths.
That one took a back seat.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Are you healthy?
I don't know. I think so. I hope so. I'm due for another checkup.
Yeah.
I had a big MOT about 3 or 4 years ago. And that was all fine, I think. At least there was nothing major wrong. So I think there were a few minor notes about cholesterol and things like that. But because I didn't have, you know, because it wasn't like a death sentence, I kind of skipped out going, I'm fine, I'm fine. So
it's good, isn't it, when you get that? I've got to go for an MRI next week, which I hate. I can't do them. I can't get in there. Last time they put me in one, and I said, get me out of here quick.
It's terrifying, isn't it?
I just couldn't do it. So I ended up having to pay for it, but they got me head, which is all they wanted.
Yeah. And that's just a checkup.
I've got a what's called a vestibular schwannoma.
Whoa.
It's like it's a tumour in my head.
Yeah.
And it's because I've gone completely deaf, 100% deaf in my left ear, and it'll never come back, but it's like a... It's like the size of a grape. So they just have to keep an eye on it.
So it's not malignant?
No, it's benign.
Okay. And your hearing won't come back after they've removed it?
Or they can't remove it. Well, they can shrink it.
Okay.
Or they can just leave it and keep an eye on it. And that's what they're doing.
Did that not really distress you?
Well, no, not really. I just sort of thought, yeah, I'd rather hear than not. But yeah. It's happened. So you just get on with it, don't you?
That's good. I think I would have been a massive pain in the arse if that happened to me.
Well, I've just got used to it. It's because I like going out bird watching and I never know where the birds are.
Yes.
Because I can hear them. I don't know what direction they're in. You know, if an aeroplane flies over or a car approaches, I don't know where it is.
Right, okay.
Because I had to throw away all my stereo LPs.
I was going to say, like, what about, have you got nothing in there whatsoever?
No, it's dead as a dot. Absolutely, completely gone.
It just seems to me like, as someone who is absolutely ignorant about medicine and science and technology, I still think, like, come on, 2021, how complicated is an ear? Surely you can fix it. Just...
Well, what's done is, like the eardrum and your brain, there's a nerve, and that takes all the information from your ear to your brain, and the tumour is right in between the nerve, so it's gone... ping and snapped it.
Okay.
And you can't reattach nerves. Not at this stage in medical science, but in the future. Probably the week after I perish. Great news for people who...
It's a simple operation to reattach an aural nerve.
Seconds of your time and you'll be able to hear and see again.
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? Unless things change absolutely disastrously, that's what medical science will do at some point.
Yeah.
In the not-too-distant future.
Yeah,
all these things that we
consider. My dad died of prostate cancer.
Right.
And about a year later, they were going, here's the cure.
Yeah.
Well, not the cure, but, you know, he would have lived.
He would have survived. I know. All the people that died of AIDS, I always think, like, Jesus. And now it's, you can live with it fine.
So I'm living with deafness.
Yeah. And you're a hero.
Can you imagine a life without stereo records?
Terrible.
No more will I hear Jimi Hendrix, and well, the producer doing Six Was Nine. It goes all over the place. Wow, 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 all that. I thought it was great when people worked out like stereo when it first happened. And they'd be going, like, oh, let's just go. It's like if we've got a new toy here. We're going to put it all over every record and phasing on drums.
Yeah.
Do the phasing on the drums and the stereo. That's great, isn't it?
Yeah, I love it. And I love those very extreme mixes that George Martin would do on the Beatles, and that Paul Botnick or whoever it was doing the Doors as well, you know, so you'd have all the vocals in one channel and everything else in the other one. And it was sort of mad, but it really works. And when the Beatles did the reissues, the mono mixes, I didn't like them nearly as much.
That's all I can listen to now.
It's a mono mix.
I have to throw everything out. All I've got left is Frank Ifield on mono.
I remember you.
Wait.
This is an advert for Squarespace. Hey guys, it's Broshak with me, Paul Broshak. We got Mike here. We're going to talk about his new MMA comedy special. We're going to talk about his view counts, and we're going to talk about conspiracy theories. What's up, Mike?
Hello, Paul.
Hey, brother.
I'm fine, thank you. I don't want to talk about any of those things anymore.
You don't?
No. I want to talk about... I built a website, Paul.
All right, stream some fights, settle some beefs, stick it to the elites, that kind of thing.
No, it's mainly dog pictures, Paul. And I did it on Squarespace. Have you heard of Squarespace? I went to squarespace.com/Buxton and I did a free trial. And I tried some of the beautiful templates, Paul, and I typed things in. I dragged in pictures of the dogs. And before I knew it, I had a website, Paul. So I bought it, and I've made some very sweet dog t-shirts, and I sell those on the shop on the website.
Uh-huh. But do you still fight and stuff?
A little bit, but not really. Oh, and Paul, I wanted to tell you that when it comes time to buy your website or domain on Squarespace, if you use the offer code Buxton, you save 10%. Paul.
Thanks, Mike. Where'd you do that free trial?
Squarespace.com/Buxton.
And how sweet were the dogs?
Very.
Continue.
Rosie, where are you?
Oh, it's always a bit of a risk coming out with dog at this time of the day, you know, when the sun's going down. It's pretty much, well, it's gone down. And there's just a few bits of light over to the west. And I can't see dog. Oh, yes, I can. A little blurry, hairy bullet emerging from the gloom and loping towards me. She's had a bad eye. Actually, she had... First, the left eye was bad, and then the right eye was bad. But we had some drops that cleared that up pretty well. But she had to wear a inflatable collar. It used to be the cone for that kind of thing, which nobody enjoyed, least of all dog. But the inflatable... It's a bit like one of those inflatable neck pillows that you can get for travelling. It works quite well to stop her scratching away at the eye when it's under repair. Anyway, that's Rosie news. Thanks very much indeed to Jim Wire for talking to me there, giving up his time, letting me come and visit him at his house out in Kent. Yeah, it was wonderful to be back in an actual room with someone. We were both fully vaccinated. I've had COVID. So it was all very responsible. And all in all, it was a really fun trip. I hope you enjoyed listening to that conversation. A couple of clarifications, qualifications, whatever you want to call them. My producer, Seamus, said about AIDS. I made a comment about people living with AIDS. Seamus says, worth saying, people are no longer dying of AIDS in the developed world. They are living with HIV, a manageable chronic disease. Video games. When I was editing this episode and listening back, I thought, actually, maybe I should clarify, because it sounds as if I said, well, I think, you know, no disrespect to gamers and the people in the industry, but I think video games are a total waste of time. What I actually meant was that I feel that's my unreasonable prejudice. Like, I feel guilt after I have a long video game session. I love video games, and they have been a wonderful bonding experience for me and my children and my brother, all of whom I've had some very wonderful, memorable times playing Bomberman and Pikmin and Donkey Kong and Crash Bandicoot and all that stuff. But I still have this thing, and I know it's daft. Also, there are more and more studies coming out pointing out all the positive effects there are for video games. I've actually put a link to an article on the Mental Floss website outlining 15 surprising benefits of playing video games, some of which are more convincing than others, I have to say. And yeah, you know, they could definitely help you with all sorts of things. You know, getting into pipes, jumping up for coins, jumping on turtles. These are not very up-to-date references, sorry. All right, that's it for this week's podcast. Thank you very much once again to Jim Moyer for his time. Thanks to Seamus Murphy Mitchell very much indeed for his work on this episode and the edit and his ongoing production support. Thanks, Seamus. Thanks to Helen Green, who does the artwork for this podcast. Thanks to Acast for all their help. And thanks, I would say most of all, to you. You listen right to the end. You're slow to judge, kind, open-minded, thoughtful. Whenever I meet you, I just think, how did I get so lucky? This is starting to sound sarcastic now, but I do actually think all those things. And that's why I'm going to lean towards you. I washed earlier this week, and so I smell pretty good, although I'm not sure because I still can't really smell. And in the most respectful way possible, I'm just going to embrace you and give you a quick hug, if that's okay. Till next time, please take care. I love you. Bye!